You're listening to On Attachment, a place to learn about how attachment shapes the way we experience relationships and where you'll gain the guidance, knowledge, and practical tools to overcome insecurity and build healthy, thriving relationships. I'm your host, relationship coach Stephanie Rigg, and I'm really glad you're here. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of On Attachment. In today's episode, I'm going to be giving you five similarities between anxiously attached people and avoidantly attached people. Now, obviously, there's a lot of talk around the ways in which people with these attachment styles differ, and that's certainly true and valid. There are lots of differences in how their insecurities show up, but today I wanted to offer you a counterpoint or another way of looking at those behaviors and the ways that they can manifest in relationships so that you can maybe have a different perspective on the ways in which you are similar or where you might have similar fears, similar struggles and challenges when it comes to relationships. And as always, I'm offering that to you in the hope that it can help you to cultivate greater curiosity and compassion towards both yourself and your partner or other people in your life who, you know, in the absence of that viewpoint, you might be inclined to judge them or become frustrated with them or critical of them because of the ways in which their behavioral patterns might differ from yours and how that might be frustrating or hurtful to you. I think that as always, you know, if you're familiar with my work, if you've been following me for some time, you'll know that I always stress the importance of understanding that our systems are just trying to keep us safe. And that's really, you know, the number one imperative of our systems when it comes to relationships or really anything else is to keep us safe, to protect us from harm. And so when we have all these fears that are deeply entrenched and embedded in our systems, then that harm can look like different things for different people. And, you know, no matter what it is or what it looks like, usually these patterns and behaviors can be traced back to a part of us trying to keep us safe from a perceived threat or danger. So while that's not an excuse for, you know, bad behavior, it does provide context that allows us to turn towards ourselves and others with greater compassion. And I find that that's a really important stepping stone on the way to greater connection and healthier relationships. So I'm hoping that today's episode in offering you, that alternative perspective on ways in which you might actually be more similar with your partner than you realize, that you can start to cultivate some of that compassion and curiosity. Before we do that, a couple of quick announcements. Just the first, in case you missed it last week, an announcement that we've moved to 2 episodes per week. So I hope that that's exciting news for those of you who love the podcast. Just make sure that you're subscribed or following the show or whatever it is called on the platform that you're listening to, so that you don't miss any episodes. The second announcement is just to share the review of the week. So this one says, and I've trimmed this a little because it was quite long. I stumbled across Stephanie's podcast in my search for a deeper understanding of my own behavioral patterns in romantic relationships. After years of toxic relational dynamics, I was desperate to break the cycle and gain deeper clarity about my own mind and its wiring. From my very first podcast episode, I found Stephanie brought her insight with compassion and gentleness that felt like a warm hug from a friend. She pairs deep knowledge with her signature ability to validate and guide from a place of respect and genuine care. Thank you for that beautiful review. If that was your review, please could you send an email to podcast@stephanierigg.com and we will set you up with free access to one of my masterclasses as a way to say thank you for the kind words, for the support, and for taking the time to leave a review. And as I said, if you would like to have your review shared on the show and if you'd like to potentially win a free masterclass, just leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Unfortunately, reviews are not available on Spotify. And you'll now have 2 opportunities per week with the 2 episodes per week to win a prize. So it is really super helpful to me. Every review counts and it's just a really effective way of getting the word out there. So always grateful for those of you who do take the time to leave a review. Okay, so let's dive into these 5 similarities between anxiously attached people and avoidantly attached people. Now, I should say at the outset, whenever I speak about avoidant without distinguishing between dismissive avoidant and fearful avoidant, that's usually because it applies to both. So in other words, I mean, this episode could probably be titled Five Things That People with an Insecure Attachment Style Have in Common, in that it is kind of all encompassing for those who are not securely attached. I should also say, because you know that I love a disclaimer and a caveat, of course, there is huge individual variation from person to person. This is not going to be true for every single person that falls into any of these categories. As always, you know, these are general observations. Take what works, leave what doesn't. Don't feel the need to try and fit yourself or someone else into a mold just for the sake of ticking a box. We are all more complicated than that. Okay, so let's kick off. The first similarity that I want to talk about is that neither anxious nor avoidant people trust in the safety of relationships. So on the anxious side, the fear that drives that mistrust is a fear of abandonment. It's, I'm going to be left. I can't trust that even if you're here, and even if, you know, I love you and I know you love me, I'd never feel fully safe. I never feel like I can fully relax into this relationship without this lingering fear that something bad's going to happen, that you're going to, you know, fall out of love with me, or you're going to meet someone else, or we're going to have a fight, or some other bad catastrophic thing is going to happen. Even when there's no evidence to suggest that, it's really hard for an anxiously attached person to ever feel like there's just enough, right? And even if, you know, there are no ostensible threats to the relationship, they'll start nitpicking and testing and seeking reassurance from their partner to always be looking for this greater level of security that can feel really unattainable. And, you know, it often is unattainable unless you've done that deeper work to understand what's really driving those behaviors and those thoughts and those insecurities. So on the anxious side, it's driven by this fear of abandonment. On the avoidant side, there's a lot to unpack, right? And not trusting in the safety of relationships. But if we go to the origin story of a lot of avoidant attachment, it's that an avoidantly attached person has never really experienced safe connection with an attachment figure. So for a lot of avoidant people, the way that that avoidant attachment style came to be was that their attachment cues were rebuffed or ignored as a baby, as a child, an infant. And so they sort of learned to switch off that part of themselves, whether that's because they were shamed for being emotional or for reaching for a parent, were told not to cry, were ignored, were ridiculed or belittled. Any of those things can lead the child to internalize that messaging of connection doesn't happen via, you know, emotionality and attunement. That's just not going to get me what I need. And so they tend to switch off that part of themselves pretty early on and instead channel their energy and attention into things that are going to work to get their needs met, which for a lot of people is, you know, being competent, achieving, working hard, doing those sorts of more outward things that might have gotten them the approval and therefore some semblance of connection and validation from caregivers that they weren't getting on an emotional level. So because of all of that, for the avoidant person, there isn't really an experience of safe, vulnerable closeness with another person. And it brings up, in a lot of cases, fear of being smothered, being controlled. The idea of someone depending on them can feel very suffocating and overwhelming. And likewise, the idea of them having to depend on someone else can feel very like a loss of control, because they've become very, very good at self-sufficiency and independence and autonomy. They've really crafted their identity and, you know, their way of being in the world. That's their blueprint of, I'll take care of me and you can take care of you. So this idea of sacrificing some of that, you know, that sense of self that you've carved out and protected so fiercely, the idea of loosening the grip on that and yielding to someone else and meeting in the middle can feel like a loss of self, which can feel really, really terrifying for an avoidant person. So on both sides, we see it might look a little different. It might show up in different ways, but there is this fundamental mistrust in the safety of relationships. There is a real difficulty in assuming the best, in kind of trusting that people are good and relationships are good and healthy and happy, and that there isn't just this kind of lingering threat and fear that we need to be guarding against, even if that, specific fear is different on each side. Okay, so the next one that I want to speak to is they both tend to have poor boundaries. So again, we can see that the boundaries, the way they show up, tends to be different. So on the anxious side, poor boundaries often means porous boundaries. So very flimsy boundaries that can mean, on the incoming sense of kind of allowing people to treat you however they want, not advocating for yourself, kind of the classic being a doormat, that expression and that kind of energy of letting people walk all over you, never really standing up for yourself, never voicing concerns, never letting people know when something's uncomfortable for you because, you don't want to push them away or you don't want to make anyone uncomfortable. You don't want to cause a fuss. You don't want to make anyone feel bad. So you very consistently deprioritize what works for you in favor of keeping the peace or keeping people close or whatever. That tends to be the poorest incoming boundary for the anxious person. And similarly, and I think this is less talked about, but I think it's very important to talk about, anxiously attached people tend to be very bad at respecting other people's boundaries. So someone might say, please don't contact me. And I'll have clients and students say, yeah, but I think I should still message them because they don't know what I'm going to say and they don't know X, Y, and Z thing. And that's why I think it's still really important. Or maybe they mean this, or maybe they're just saying it because they're scared and that's why I have to reach out. All of this mental acrobatics to try and justify pushing someone else's boundary. Because for the anxious person, connection reigns supreme and boundaries are a lesser concern. So porous boundaries on both sides, right? I let anyone do, sort of walk all over me, and I tend to push the boundaries on the other side as well. For the avoidant person, poor boundaries looks like rigid boundaries. So it's, the 10-meter iron gate keeping people out. And it's kind of just this rigidity, and it can show up as being quite black and white, quite controlling, having very little tolerance for shades of gray or for compromise or for, seeing different perspectives. There can be this sense of, it's my way or the highway, and having very strict boundaries and having a very visceral response to any suggestion or hint of a boundary violation. So if it feels like someone is, nearing your boundary, there can be a very strong response, a really strong protective response to reinforce that boundary and make very clear to that person how unacceptable it is to even go near the boundary. The boundary is often a non-negotiable. There's no wriggle room on it. There's no flexibility at all. So I think some people who are maybe newer to understanding boundaries and what healthy boundaries look like think that rigid boundaries are healthy boundaries. Oh, you're so good at boundaries because of how, clear and hard they are. But the reality is that really kind of strict black and white rigid boundary is not a healthy boundary either. And so that's why I'm saying that really the boundary point, even though it shows up differently for anxious and avoidant people, is something that they have in common, that neither are really great at navigating the healthy middle. And that makes sense because the reality is when you have, attachment insecurities, when you have any sort of wounding relational trauma, a lot of the time that manifests in this world of black and white. It's not shades of gray. It's not being able to play in the both and, as we'd say, it's either or, it's one or the other. We really struggle to navigate that. And I think that there's a whole nother conversation to be had there. But I think that very much shows up in the boundary piece as applied to anxious and avoidant attachment. Okay. The next one is that neither anxious nor avoidant people are very good at being vulnerable. So I think this is really interesting because I think that of course, there's a lot of talk about avoidant people not being vulnerable, being emotionally unavailable, being unemotional, all of that, not having emotional intelligence, whatever you might call it. And I think often that criticism is coming from anxiously attached people who consider themselves to be, you know, very emotionally literate, to, you know, having high EQ and being good at that kind of emotionality and vulnerability. But I actually think that anxiously attached people, yes, are often very emotionally attuned. They're very kind of in touch with other people's emotions. They can read emotions. They can empathize very well. They can talk about those things. But I actually think that a lot of anxiously attached people are not very good at being vulnerable themselves. They're really good at caring for others. They're very good at tending to others. And they may be quite emotional themselves in the sense of they might have big emotions from time to time. But I don't think either of those things are true vulnerability. I don't think that caretaking for other people is really vulnerability. And I don't think that having emotional outbursts and being dysregulated is vulnerability. So I think what vulnerability means to me is being willing to sit in the mess of uncertainty and to show someone what's really going on to you. It's getting those protective parts of you that have their swords raised or their shields raised and the kind of army of protectors that jump to our defense so quickly when we're in fear, finding a way to get those parts to stand down, to stand aside so that you can connect person to person and say, I'm scared, rather than saying, how could you do that? What were you thinking? Any person would know this. What's wrong with you? You can't keep doing this. All of those things are coming from fear. So while you might think like, oh, I was being vulnerable because I was sharing my emotions, that's not the same thing in my mind. I think being vulnerable is letting the guard down. So it's not coming from anger. It's not coming from threat. It's not coming from criticism. It's really sharing like the underlying tenderness of whatever it is you're experiencing. And I think that anxiously attached people are not as good at doing that as they might think. I think another piece to vulnerability is that anxiously attached people are not very good at asking for help, and neither are avoidant people, right? So I think that that's another commonality that, again, we think of avoidant people as being the ones that are hyper independent and kind of keep people at arm's length and want to do everything themselves. But I actually think that a lot of anxiously attached people are not very good at asking for help. They're not very good at receiving, right? They're very good givers and overgivers, I would say. It's really in the same vein as the vulnerability point. You can be really good at, you know, being a listening ear, being a support person to other people. But I don't think it's true vulnerability unless you're allowing yourself to be seen. We want to see the vulnerability in someone else and not let them see it in us. That's not really how it goes. So having that healthy reciprocity is a really important piece. Okay, so the next one that I wanted to speak to is that both anxious and avoidant people can have an aversion to conflict. Now, I say can because I think that it would be fair to say most avoidant people have an aversion to conflict. I think that's pretty standard across the board. I think that anxious people tend to go between. So there's, I think there's like avoiding conflict up until a point, and it's avoiding having needs, avoiding asking for anything, avoiding raising issues from this place of kind of shrinking and not wanting to be difficult, not wanting to push someone away, not wanting to set a boundary, because there's always this lingering fear of, if I put my foot down, what if they just say, okay, see you later, and walk away? That's obviously really scary for a lot of anxious people, and I think that fear lingers. So there's always a lot of dissatisfaction from the anxious person. There are always a lot of things that they wish they could raise and that they want to raise. And there's always, you know, there's always something that feels not right about the relationship, but they tend to suppress that up until a point. And so there tends to be this point of overwhelm or a breaking point of some description where they're no longer able to keep the lid on all of those things that they've been suppressing and swallowing and not saying. And so then it turns into this big explosive conflict. So I sort of give that caveat because I realize, you know, a lot of literature around attachment would describe anxious people as being quite fiery and being quite nitpicky and maybe being, you know, causing conflict. And I think that it can be true that anxious people can find conflict as a way to connect. And particularly if their partner's very disengaged, then throwing those hand grenades and connecting via conflict feels safer than just disconnecting and kind of living in the void of disconnection, for sure. But I think that anxious people, up until they reach that breaking point, tend to be very conflict averse and tend to suppress. They're not very good at just raising things in real time in a regulated way and having that safe, healthy dialogue in a relationship because there's so much fear associated with taking up space. On the avoidance side, I think that it would be fair to say that conflict and any sort of, you know, big emotions can feel really overwhelming straight out of the gate. Being in the presence of someone else's emotions can be overwhelming because a lot of avoidant people have not learned to do that, to kind of hold space for another person's emotions and to know what to say, to know how to support. They can really jump to a problem-solving place, which might not be what the person needs, and then it escalates and it's a whole thing, right? You know, their bodies can really just go into shutdown and overwhelm very quickly. I think the other thing that avoidant people struggle with when it comes to conflict is feeling like a failure. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that a lot of avoidant people's kind of survival strategy is around competence. You know, I'll do good. I'll achieve. I'll be productive and effective. And that's how I'm going to get my sense of value in the world. And so when they're in relationship, and particularly with a more anxious partner who does have this strong negativity bias and tendency to nitpick and always find something that's wrong with the relationship, somewhere where it could be improved, something that, you know, is some kind of cue for danger around the relationship, the avoidant person can feel very demoralized and feel like there's just a barrage of criticism and attack, and there's always something, and no matter how hard they try, they can never get it right, and then their partner's never pleased. And so they can feel like a failure, and that can really get at that core wound of theirs. So I think for that reason, conflict on both sides can feel pretty unsafe, and there's a lot of stuff around conflict, which is why so many anxious avoided couples tend to not have very productive conflict and can have really ugly fights, you know, that are suppressed, and then there's a big volcanic eruption and it, you know, spirals into dysregulation and all those other things. Okay, so the last one that I want to give you, the last similarity between anxious and avoidant people is that they both struggle to stay regulated in times of relational stress, and this sort of flows nicely from the last one around conflict. You know, I've done other episodes around nervous system regulation. I'm probably due for another one soon. But in times of relational stress, you know, the anxious person is going to go into sympathetic arousal almost always, very quickly. And that's the zone of fight or flight. It's the mobilization energy of, I'm sensing a threat. I need to do something. I need to protect myself. I need to, you know, I need to solve this problem. Firefighter mode, right? Avoidant people, and particularly dismissive avoidants, tend to go more into what's called their dorsal vagal state, which is essentially a state of shutdown, of despondency, of numbness, of blankness, of, you know, there's nothing I can do. They're really struggling to stay connected because their nervous system takes them so quickly out of their bodies. And, you know, again, there's a whole nother episode in that, but that's a pretty brilliant survival mechanism, as is the mobilization state of the sympathetic nervous system. But it is that, you know, I can't be with what is happening in my body right now. This feels so overwhelming and so unsafe that I'm just going to check out, right? My brain is kind of going to take me offline so I don't have to be with this. And a lot of avoidant people will relate to that feeling of just feeling like they leave their body in times of stress or conflict, that they actually can't find the words and they can't really remember what happened. They feel a bit dazed and confused because they've gone into this state of their nervous system. And that tends to be exacerbated. You know, the anxious person perceives that as disengagement and disinterest because they might be sitting there staring into space. So they escalate their attempts at connection and conflict. And the avoidant person receives this really intense fight or flight energy, fight in that case, energy from the anxious person and just feels completely attacked and vulnerable and really, really unsafe. So it tends to spiral from there. So both anxious and avoidant people really struggle to regulate and bring themselves back because, you know, for the anxious person, they just get so heightened so quickly and so overwhelmed, and they tend not to have a great capacity to self-soothe and to bring themselves back to regulation. And on the avoidant side, they do tend to go to those extremes very quickly and just kind of go offline. Okay, so those were the five similarities between anxious and avoidant people. I hope that that has been a helpful reframe, that it's given you something to think about, and that maybe the next time you notice something like that coming up in your relationship, that you're able to see it through more compassionate eyes and to realize that you're both afraid. You know, I know in my relationship, there are certainly times where, even though we're coming from those different starting points, when I can step outside of my experience and go, oh, like, we're both feeling really threatened right now. We're both feeling really, you know, afraid. We're both whatever, but like I can connect with the kind of underlying similarity between how we're feeling. That's a very connective experience. So even if it's showing up differently for us and we're telling ourselves different stories and all of our protective parts are coming out to keep us safe, when we can really tune into what's actually going on there and the fact that, you know, we do love and care about each other and that we do, you know, have these points of commonality or common ground between us, I think that that can be very healing and certainly can pave the way for, you know, healthier connection. So if you've enjoyed this episode, as always, super grateful if you can subscribe, leave a rating, leave a review. It all really helps. And yeah, I'll see you again next week. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of On Attachment. If you want to go deeper on all things attachment, love, and relationships, you can find me on Instagram at Stephanie_Rigg or at stephanierigg.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, I'd be so grateful if you could leave a review and a 5-star rating. It really does help so much. Thanks again for being here, and I hope to see you again soon.